This is Audible.
Where Wizards Stay Up Late: The Origins of the Internet. Written by Katie Hafner and Matthew Lyon. Narrated by Mark Douglas Nelson. Chapter 5. Do It to It, Truett! Steve Crocker and Vint Cerf had been best friends since attending Van Nuys High School in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. They shared a love for science, and the two spent more than a few Saturday nights building three-dimensional chess games, or trying to recreate Edwin Land's experiments with color perception. Vint was a wiry, intense, effusive kid. He joined his high school ROTC unit to avoid gym class. On the days he didn't show up at school in his ROTC uniform, Vint wore a jacket and tie, and he always toted a large brown briefcase. By local standards, it was an unusual mode of dress, even in the late 1950s. "I use the coat and tie to distinguish myself from the crowd. Maybe a nerd's way of being different," he recalled. Nonetheless, much to the consternation of his friends, Vint never had trouble attracting the attention of the opposite sex. He was, everyone agreed, one of a kind. From an early age, Vint aspired to match the accomplished track record of his father, who had risen through the ranks to become a senior executive at North American Aviation, now Rockwell International. Both of Vint's younger brothers played football and took turns as president of the student body. Vint was the bookworm. His literary tastes tilted toward fantasy. Well into his adult life, he regularly set aside several days to reread the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Vint did particularly well in chemistry, but his passion was math. When Steve Crocker started the math club at Van Nuys High, Vint was one of the first to join. As a result of premature birth, Vint was hearing impaired. Although hearing aids in both ears later corrected much of the deficit, he grew up devising clever strategies for communicating in the hearing world. Years later, after they became friends, Bob Kahn brought some of Cerf's oral tricks to his friend's attention, and Cerf eventually wrote a paper called Confessions of a Hearing Impaired Engineer, in which he shared some of his secrets. In particularly noisy environments, cafeterias, restaurants, and homes with dogs and small children, the deaf person's reliance on conversational context often suffers badly. A typical strategy here is to dominate the conversation, not by doing all the talking, but by asking a lot of questions. In this way, the deaf listener will at least know what question the speaker is addressing, even if he cannot hear all of the response. In a group conversation, this can backfire embarrassingly if the question you ask is one which was just asked by someone else. A variation, equally embarrassing, is to enthusiastically suggest something just suggested. For example, Friend A, I wonder what the origin of this term is. Friend B, why don't we look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary? Friend A, yeah, but too bad we don't have an OED. Cerf, I know, why don't we look it up in the Oxford English Dictionary? Steve Crocker drifted in and out of Vint's life. Steve's parents were divorced, and he spent his high school years shuttling between suburban Chicago and the San Fernando Valley. Always precocious, Steve grew up knowing he was probably the smartest kid in any given room. At age 13, while home one day with a cold, he taught himself the elements of calculus. At the end of 10th grade, he learned the rudiments of computer programming. "I remember being thrilled when I finally understood the concept of a loop," Crocker recalled, "which enabled the computer to proceed with a very lengthy sequence of operations with only a relatively few instructions. I was a bit callow, but I remember thinking this was the kind of revelation that must have led Archimedes to run down the street naked yelling, 'Eureka!'" Around 1960, when Steve had returned to L.A., Vint followed him into the computer lab at UCLA. Although still in high school, Steve had gotten permission to use the UCLA computer, but the only free time he and Vint had was on the weekends. One Saturday, they arrived to find the computer lab building locked. "I couldn't see any choice but to give up and go home," said Crocker. but they looked up and saw an open second-story window. They looked at each other. "Next thing I know, Vint is on my shoulders," Crocker recalled. Cerf went through the window and, once inside, opened the door and taped the latch so they could go in and out of the building. "When the Watergate burglars did the same thing a dozen years later and got caught, I shuddered," said Crocker. After high school, Cerf attended Stanford on a four-year scholarship from his father's company. He majored in math, but soon got hooked on serious computing. "There was something amazingly enticing about programming," he said. "You created your own universe, and you were the master of it. The computer would do anything you programmed it to do. It was this unbelievable sandbox in which every grain of sand was under your control." After graduating in 1965, Cerf decided he wanted to work for a while before going on to graduate school. IBM was recruiting on the Stanford campus, and Cerf took a job at IBM in Los Angeles. He went to work as the systems engineer for an IBM timesharing system. Realizing he needed better grounding in computer science, he soon joined his friend Crocker, now a graduate student in UCLA's computer science department. Computer science was still a young discipline, and UCLA's PhD program, one of the first in the country, was one of only a dozen in existence at the time. Cerf arrived just as Crocker was leaving for MIT. Crocker's thesis advisor at UCLA was Jerry Estrin, the same professor Paul Barron had worked with a few years earlier. Estrin had an ARPA contract for the Snooper computer, which used one computer to observe the execution of programs running on a second machine. Estrin took on Cerf as a research student for the project. It became the basis for Cerf's doctoral thesis. In the summer of 1968, Crocker returned to UCLA and joined Cerf in Estrin's group. For both Cerf and Crocker, 1968 marked the beginning of a lifelong fascination with the networking of computers. For Cerf, computer networking would become the centerpiece of his professional career. Although Crocker would move on to other things for long stretches at a time, he too would eventually return to the field of networking. In the fall of 1968, ARPA transferred its contract from Estrin to Len Kleinrock at UCLA. Kleinrock was setting up his network measurement center with a $200,000 annual contract from ARPA. By coincidence, when Kleinrock got the contract, the person in the office next door conveniently moved out, so Kleinrock expanded his domain. He tore down the wall between the two offices and installed a large conference table for meetings with students and staff. The meetings were frequent as Kleinrock busily built a small empire. In planning the ARPA network, Larry Roberts had conceived of the Network Measurement Center as the organization that would be responsible for most of the performance testing and analysis. The measurement center was intended to be roughly analogous to a test track where drivers push the outer limits of high-performance cars. Kleinrock and his group were in charge of gathering data, total network response time, traffic density, delays, and capacity, the measures needed to evaluate how the network is performing. Like Bob Kahn, Kleinrock had a theoretician's bent. His business was simulation, modeling, and analysis. Through simulations, he had come as close as he could to monitoring the ways in which networks perform without actually having a network to run. He welcomed the chance to test his theories on the real thing. The engineers at BBN didn't pay too much attention to Kleinrock. They thought he was a trifle heavy on theory and fairly light on engineering. The skepticism was mutual, for Kleinrock believed that the BBN team was largely uninterested in performance. BBN's programmers were outstanding, but, said Kleinrock, "by and large, a programmer simply wants to get a piece of software that works. That's hard enough. Whether it works efficiently or well is not usually the issue." He was unaware, perhaps, of Walden and Crowther's obsession with software efficiency. But in any case, perfecting network performance, Kleinrock decided, was his job. Before long, Kleinrock was managing 40 students who helped run the center. Crocker and Cerf were among the senior members of Kleinrock's group. Another important member was John Postel. He had a long bushy beard, wore sandals year-round, and never put on a tie in his life. Always dapper and generally more conservative, Cerf presented a striking contrast to Postel's steadfastly casual appearance. Crocker, the unofficial leader, was somewhere in the middle. He had grown a beard at MIT. Cops looked at me a little harder, but girls were a lot friendlier, and that was a trade-off I could live with, Crocker said, but was willing to put on a pair of dress shoes every now and then. While Cerf and Crocker were academic stars, Postel, who was 25, had had a more checkered academic career. He had grown up in nearby Glendale and Sherman Oaks, and he too had attended Van Nuys High School, where his grades were mediocre. Postel's interest in computers developed at a local community college. By the time he got to UCLA to finish an undergraduate degree in engineering, the closest thing to computer science at the time, computing was his life. UCLA eventually decided to establish computer science as a formal department, at just about the time Postel was entering the university's graduate school. Postel was quiet, but he had strong opinions. The people running the computer science department occasionally interpreted the firmness of Postel's opinions as a bad attitude. In 1966, Cerf had married a young illustrator named Sigrid. She was profoundly deaf. Their first meeting had been contrived by their hearing aid dealer, who scheduled adjacent appointments for them one Saturday morning in hopes that they would cross paths and hit it off. They went to lunch, and Sigrid was awestruck by her companion's eclectic curiosity. Vint seemed to dance in his chair with excitement as he described his work with computers. They extended their tête-à-tête with a visit to the Los Angeles County Museum of Art to see some of Sigrid's favorite paintings. Unschooled in art but eager to learn, Cerf stared for a long time at a huge Kandinsky. "This thing reminds me of a green hamburger," he finally remarked. A year later, they were married, with Steve Crocker as Vint's best man, roles that would be reversed a few years later. Crocker's electronics expertise came in handy when, minutes before the ceremony was to begin, he discovered the tape recorder for the wedding music was malfunctioning. Best man and frantic groom retreated to a tiny room near the altar and fixed it just in time. Kleinrock, although only 10 years older than the rest of his group, had a great reputation in queuing theory, the study of how long people and things spend waiting in lines, how long the lines get, and how to design systems to reduce waiting. He had already published a book, and he was in charge of a growing lab. His energy seemed boundless. Moreover, he was one of just a handful of scientists who had produced analytic models of store and forward networks before Roberts got started on the ARPA project. At the time, the UCLA Computer Science Department owned a computer made by Scientific Data Systems called the Sigma 7, the latest in that firm's line of computers. UCLA also had three major computer centers equipped with IBM 7094 mainframes. But the Sigma 7 was a machine assigned to the graduate students. No one liked the Sigma 7 much. It was unreliable and difficult to program. As a member of the UCLA team put it, the Sigma 7 was a dog. "But it was our dog," Cerf said years later. It was also the only computer they had to play with. Until, that is, the ARPA network came along. Not only would the computer scientists at UCLA be receiving the first IMP, but presumably the network would open doors to all kinds of different host machines at the other sites. The most pressing task in the summer of 1969 was to build the interface, a combination of hardware and software, between the Sigma 7 and the IMP. As the UCLA guys understood it, BBN was working out some specifications for how to construct such a connection. The host-to-IMP interface had to be built from scratch each time a new site was established around a different computer model. Later, sites using the same model could purchase copies of the custom interface. Nearly as urgent was the more far-reaching challenge of writing the software that allowed host computers throughout the network to communicate with one another. This was to be the host-to-host protocol, a very broad-based set of operating terms that would be common to all machines. It had to be like a traveler's check, good anywhere and able to support a gamut of applications, from remote logins to file transfers to text processing. Inventing it wouldn't be easy. In the summer of 1968, a small group of graduate students from the first four host sites, UCLA, SRI, UC Santa Barbara, and the University of Utah, had met in Santa Barbara. They knew that the network was being planned, but they'd been given few details beyond that. But networking in general and the ARPA experiment in particular were hot topics. The meeting was seminal, if only because of the enthusiasm it generated. We had lots of questions: how IMPs and hosts would be connected, what hosts would say to each other, and what applications would be supported, Crocker said. No one had any answers, but the prospect seemed exciting. We found ourselves imagining all kinds of possibilities: interactive graphics, cooperating processes, automatic database query, electronic mail, but no one knew where to begin. From that meeting emerged a core of young researchers devoted to working on, thinking through, and scheming about the network's host-to-host communications. To speed up the process, they decided to meet regularly. Theoretically, a computer network would cut down on some of the ARPA-funded travel, but before long, Crocker was traveling enough that Kleinrock had to produce a separate travel budget for him. A month or so after the new group began meeting, it became clear to Crocker and others that they had better start accumulating notes on the discussions. If the meetings themselves were less than conclusive, perhaps the act of writing something down would help order their thoughts. Crocker volunteered to write the first minutes. He was an extremely considerate young man, sensitive to others. "I remember having great fear that we would offend whoever the official protocol designers were." Of course, there were no official protocol designers, but Crocker didn't know that. He was living with friends at the time and worked all night on the first note, writing in the bathroom so as not to wake anyone in the house. He wasn't worried about what he wanted to say so much as he wanted to strike just the right tone. The basic ground rules were that anyone could say anything and that nothing was official. To avoid sounding too declarative, he labeled the note "Request for Comments" and sent it out on April 7, 1969. Titled "Host Software," the note was distributed to the other sites the way all the first Request for Comments, RFCs, were distributed, in an envelope with the lick of a stamp. RFC number 1 described in technical terms the basic handshake between two computers, how the most elemental connections would be handled. Request for Comments, it turned out, was a perfect choice of titles. It sounded at once solicitous and serious. And it stuck. When you read RFC 1, you walked away from it with a sense of, "Oh, this is a club that I can play in too," recalled Brian Reed, later a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon. "It has rules, but it welcomes other members as long as the members are aware of those rules." The language of the RFC was warm and welcoming. The idea was to promote cooperation, not ego. The fact that Crocker kept his ego out of the first RFC set the style and inspired others to follow suit in the hundreds of friendly and cooperative RFCs that followed. "It is impossible to underestimate the importance of that," Reed asserted. "I did not feel excluded by a little corps of protocol kings. I felt included by a friendly group of people who recognized that the purpose of networking was to bring everybody in." For years afterward, and to this day, RFCs have been the principal means of open expression in the computer networking community, the accepted way of recommending, reviewing, and adopting new technical standards. Before long, the assemblage began calling itself the Network Working Group, or NWG. It was a high commission for the country's young and exceptionally talented communications programmers. Its main challenge was to agree in principle about protocols, how to share resources, how to transfer data, how to get things done. In real terms, that meant writing programs, or at least adopting certain rules for the way programs got written, rules to which a majority could consent. Agreement was the sine qua non. This was a community of equals. They could all write code, or rewrite the code someone else had written. The NWG was an adhocracy of intensely creative, sleep-deprived, idiosyncratic, well-meaning computer geniuses. And they always half expected, any day, to be politely thanked for their work and promptly replaced by others whom they imagined to be the field's true professionals. There was no one to tell them that they were as official as it got. The RFC, a simple mechanism for distributing documentation open to anybody, had what Crocker described as a first-order effect on the speed at which ideas were disseminated, and on spreading the networking culture. Anticipating the construction of the Network Working Group continued meeting regularly, and new terms and inventions often emerged by consensus. The very word protocol found its way into the language of computer networking based on the need for collective agreement among network users. For a long time, the word has been used for the etiquette of diplomacy and for certain diplomatic agreements. But in ancient Greek, protokolon meant the first leaf of a volume, a flyleaf attached to the top of a papyrus scroll that contained a synopsis of the manuscript, its authentication, and the date. Indeed, the word referring to the top of a scroll corresponded well to a packet's header, and the part of the packet containing address information. But a less formal meaning seemed even more fitting. The other definition of protocol is that it's a handwritten agreement between parties, typically worked out on the back of a lunch bag, Cerf remarked, which describes pretty accurately how most of the protocol designs were done. But the first few meetings of the Network Working Group were less than productive. Over the course of the spring and summer of 1969, the group continued struggling with the problems of host protocol design. Everyone had a vision of the potential for intercomputer communication, but no one had ever sat down to construct protocols that could actually be used. It wasn't BBN's job to worry about that problem. The only promise anyone from BBN had made about the planned-for sub-network of IMPs was that it would move packets back and forth and make sure they got to their destination. It was entirely up to the host computer to figure out how to communicate with another host computer or what to do with the messages once it received them. This was called the host-to-host protocol. The computers themselves were extremely egocentric devices. The typical mainframe of the period behaved as if it were the only computer in the universe. There was no obvious or easy way to engage two diverse machines in even the minimal communication needed to move bits back and forth. You could connect machines, but once connected, what would they say to each other? In those days, a computer interacted with the devices that were attached to it, like a monarch communicating with its subjects. Everything connected to the main computer performed a specific task, and each peripheral device was presumed to be ready at all times for a fetch-my-slippers type of command. In computer parlance, this relationship is known as master-slave communication. Computers were strictly designed for this kind of interaction. They send instructions to subordinate card readers, terminals, and tape units, and they initiate all dialogues. But if another device in effect tapped the computer on the shoulder with a signal that said, "Hi, I'm a computer too," the receiving machine would be stumped. The goal in devising the host-to-host protocol was to get the mainframe machines talking as peers, so that either side could initiate a simple dialogue and the other would be ready to respond with at least an acknowledgement of the other machine's existence. Steve Crocker once likened the concept of a host-to-host protocol to the invention of 2x4s. You imagine cities and buildings and houses and so forth, but all you see are trees and forest. And somewhere along the way you discover 2x4s as an intermediate building block, and you say, well, I can get 2x4s out of all these trees, Crocker recalled. We didn't have the concept of an equivalent of a 2x4, the basic protocols for getting all the computers to speak, and which would be useful for building all the applications. The computer equivalent of a 2x4 was what the network working group was trying to invent. In conceiving the protocol, the NWG members had to ask themselves a few basic questions. What form should the common base take? Should there be a single, foundational protocol in which to build all application protocols? Or should it be more complex, subdivided, layered, branched? Whatever structure they chose, they knew they wanted it to be as open, adaptable, and accessible to inventiveness as possible. The general view was that any protocol was a potential building block, and so the best approach was to define simple protocols, each limited in scope, with the exception that any of them might someday be joined or modified in various unanticipated ways. The protocol design philosophy adopted by the NWG broke ground for what came to be widely accepted as the layered approach to protocols. One of the most important goals of building the lower layer protocol between hosts was to be able to move a stream of packets from one computer to another without having to worry about what was inside the packets. The job of the lower layer was simply to move generic unidentified bits, regardless of what the bits might define – a file, an interactive session between people at two terminals, a graphical image, or any other conceivable form of digital data. Analogously, some water out of the tap is used for making coffee, some for washing dishes, and some for bathing. But the pipe and faucet don't care. They convey the water regardless. The host-to-host protocol was to perform essentially the same function in the infrastructure of the network. Designing the host-to-host protocol wasn't the only job before the group. The NWG also had to write the network applications for specific tasks, such as transferring files. As the talks grew more focused, it was decided that the first two applications should be for remote logins and file transfers. In the spring of 1969, a few months before Kleinrock and the UCLA host team were expecting to receive the first IMP, a thick envelope arrived from Cambridge. The guys at UCLA had been anticipating it. Inside the package was BBN Report 1822, the newly written set of specifications for connecting host computers to the soon-to-be-delivered IMPs. The ARPA network finally seemed to be coming into place. After months of guessing, the UCLA team now learned what it was expected to do to get its site ready and build its hardware interface. BBN Report 1822 also instructed the sites in creating a piece of software called a device driver, a collection of code and tables for controlling a peripheral device, to operate the host-to-IMP interface. And finally, BBN's issuance of the specifications clarified the boundary between the IMP and the host. It was clear that BBN planned to include no special software in the IMP for performing host-to-host communication. That problem would be left once and for all to the host computer, and thus to the NWG. This meant a lot of summertime work for the students in Los Angeles. They thought they might be able to finish building the host-to-IMP interface in time, but writing the host-to-host protocol had already stalled Crocker, Cerf, and the entire network working group for months. Rather than try to rush something out in time, they decided to tell every site to patch together its own makeshift protocols for the time being. UCLA asked technicians at Scientific Data Systems, makers of the Sigma 7, to build the interface hardware for their host-to-IMP connection. The company's response was discouraging. It would take months and probably wouldn't be finished in time for the IMP's arrival. Moreover, the company wanted tens of thousands of dollars for the job. So when a graduate student named Mike Wingfield asked for the job, he got it. And why not? Wingfield was a whiz at hardware and had just finished building a complex graphics interface for another computer. BBN's specification for the host-to-imp interactions and connections was a splendid blueprint. A cookbook of sorts, written by Bob Kahn in crystalline prose, the document was accompanied by detailed diagrams. Kahn's specification gave Wingfield the basic requirements for mating the Sigma-7 to an imp. Almost before Wingfield knew it, the summer had flown by and the interface had been built without a hitch. 1 week before the imp was scheduled to arrive on September 1st, Wingfield had the hardware finished, debugged, and ready to connect to the imp. Crocker was so impressed, he described it as a gorgeous piece of work. But trying to get the communication software done, Crocker was running behind. He had a tendency to procrastinate anyway, and the absence of the actual imp had only encouraged this tendency. Now, like anyone trying to outsmart a deadline, Crocker looked at the calendar and did a few calculations. He counted on having at least one extra day, since September 1st was Labor Day. Moreover, he had heard BBN was having some trouble with the imp's timing chain. Synchronizer bugs were horribly nasty. Their bug was his good fortune, and with a little luck, it might even buy him an extra week or two, he thought. So he was more than mildly surprised when Len Kleinrock told him that BBN was about to put the imp on an airplane due to arrive in Los Angeles on Saturday, August 30, 2 days early. In Cambridge, Frank Hart was preoccupied with the question of how best to ship the imp to UCLA. After debating for a couple of days, Hart decreed that it should go by air and that Ben Barker should go with it. A commercial flight was out of the question. The modified Honeywell 516, now officially BBN Interface Message Processor No. 1, was just too big for the cargo bay of a passenger plane. It had to go out by air freight. Had Hart been able to, he would have put Barker straight into the cargo plane's hold with his wrist handcuffed to the imp. Never mind that he had chosen the machine precisely because it was battle-hardened. The rigors of combat were nothing compared to the punishment airline freight handlers could dish out. He wanted somebody to be there, yelling at the cargo people to make sure they weren't careless with it, Barker recalled. But Barker would have to travel separately on a commercial passenger flight. Truett Thatch, a technician in BBN's Los Angeles office, would be told to meet the plane. Once the imp was created, Barker took a red magic marker and in large letters wrote, "Do it to it, Truett," on the side of the crate. It was loaded onto an early morning flight out of Boston's Logan Airport, and Thatch was there to meet it at LAX that afternoon. When he arrived, accompanied by a freight mover, he was relieved to watch the crate come off the plane, but appalled when he noticed that Barker's message to him was upside down. Somewhere along the way, the imp had been inverted an odd number of times, he observed. Thatch had the shippers write the box before loading it on their truck. Then he followed them to UCLA. It was the Saturday before Labor Day, and Thatch noticed the streets were unusually quiet all the way through Westwood and onto the campus. Barker was already waiting on the loading dock at Boulter Hall, with about a dozen other people, Kleinrock, Crocker, Postel, Wingfield, Vint, and Sigrid Cerf, and a handful of curiosity seekers. The Cerfs had brought along some champagne. Immediately upon seeing the crate, someone raised a question as to whether the crate would fit into the elevator. The imp was unpacked so it could be wedged in. When the machine was removed from the crate, the welcoming party was surprised by its size. Though smaller than the Sigma-7, it was not a small device. It was roughly the size of a refrigerator, weighing more than 900 pounds, and was formidably encased in battleship gray steel, exactly to military specifications. There were four steel eye-bolts on top of the imp for lifting it onto a ship by crane or helicopter. At UCLA, the imp was like a soldier in combat fatigues crashing a faculty party. When the elevator reached the third floor, the freight movers wheeled the machine down the hall and around the corner to its new home in room 3400. The Sigma 7 hummed nearby, oblivious to the massive disturbance that was about to invade its privacy. "It was a little like seeing your parents invite to dinner someone you've never met," Crocker said. "You don't pay much attention until you discover they actually intend to marry you off to this stranger." Thatch and Barker spent a few minutes cabling the imp and powering it. Instantly, the machine's core memory knew just what to do. It picked up just where it had left off in Cambridge, running the diagnostics that the imp guys had written for it. Next, Mike Wingfield attached his interface. Since this was node number one, there wasn't a network per se on which to test it. But Barker could do shunting experiments between the Sigma 7 and the imp, as they had done many times at Moulton Street between machines to simulate network links. Within an hour, the Sigma 7 and the imp were passing data back and forth as if they had been doing so for years. Barker was still not absolutely certain that the synchronizer problem had been solved, but he was confident enough to consider going home. That night, Barker called Hart. "We're done. It's all working," he said. "It's talking to Mike Wingfield stuff. I'm thinking of getting a flight home in the morning." Hart paused, and Barker sensed what might be coming. "Why don't you just hang out there a few days?" Hart responded. "Just to see if something goes wrong." Barker spent 3 days relaxing with Thatch, touring Los Angeles, and waiting for the imp to crash. It didn't. A month after the first imp was installed at UCLA, imp number two arrived at SRI, right on schedule, on October 1, 1969. That same month, Bob Taylor left ARPA. He had long since removed himself from the details of the network project. As he explained it, in the 1960s, ARPA was a magic word. Taylor's office was often called upon to sort out problems that others couldn't. In 1967 and 1968, Taylor had been sent repeatedly to Vietnam to help straighten out, among other things, the controversy over the Army's body count reports handled by the military information centers. The experience had left Taylor burned out. He took a post at the University of Utah. Many milestones in the network experiment had been passed so far. Taylor's funding victory and successful wooing of Roberts. Roberts's network concept. BBN's construction and delivery of the first imp. But the installation of IMP number 2 marked the most important achievement to date. At last, the researchers could connect two disparate computers and get them talking to each other like a couple of old comrades. Like the UCLA team earlier, SRI's group had a similar mad scramble getting ready for the arrival of the IMP. One crucial difference between the two sites was that whereas the UCLA guys disliked their Sigma 7, the SRI guys loved their host computer, an SDS-940. Like the Sigma 7, the 940 was built by Scientific Data Systems. But the Sigma 7 had been designed as a commercial processor, whereas the 940 was basically an academic device, a revolutionary time-sharing system first put together by a team of Berkeley researchers, later to be sold under the SDS nameplate. As a result, it was far more fun to program than the Sigma 7. Bill Duvall, an SRI researcher, spent about a month writing a clever program for the 940 that essentially fooled it into thinking it was communicating not with another computer, but with a dumb terminal. A dumb terminal can neither compute nor store information. It serves only to display the most recent set of information sent to it by the computer to which it's linked. Duvall's program was a very specific interim solution to the host-to-host communication problem. For weeks, the UCLA researchers had been preparing for their first login session by actually dialing into the SRI system long distance, using a modem and a teletype, to familiarize themselves with SRI's timesharing system. With both IMPs now in place and both hosts running, the moment to test the actual two-node ARPA network had finally arrived. The first thing to do, of course, was to connect. Unlike most systems today, which prompt the user for a login name and password, the SRI system waited for a command before acknowledging a connection. LOGIN was one of those commands. Fastened to the first IMPs like a barnacle was a small phone-like box with a cord and headset. It shared the line with the IMPs and used a sub-channel intended for voice conversations. The voice line was, like the data line, a dedicated link. A few days after the IMP was in place at SRI, Charlie Klein, then an undergraduate at UCLA, picked up the telephone headset in L.A. and pressed a button that rang a bell on the IMP in Menlo Park. A researcher in Engelbart's group at SRI answered it. It was somehow more thrilling to Klein than dialing a regular telephone. The quality of the connection was not very good, and both men were sitting in noisy computer rooms, which didn't help. So Klein fairly yelled into the mouthpiece, "I'm going to type an L!" Klein typed an L. "Did you get the L?" he asked. "I got 114," the SRI researcher replied. He was reading off the encoded information in octal, a code using numbers expressed in base 8. When Klein did the conversion, he saw it was indeed an L that had been transmitted. He typed an O. "Did you get the O?" he asked. "I got 117, came the reply. It was an O. Klein typed a G. "The computer just crashed," said the person at SRI. The failure came thanks to a clever bit of programming on Duval's part. Once the SRI machine recognized the letters LOG, it completed the word. "I think that is where the bug was," Klein recalled. When the SRI 940 system received the G, it tried to send back GIN, and the terminal program wasn't ready to handle more than one character at a time. Later that day, they tried again. This time, it worked flawlessly. Crocker, Cerf, and Postel went to Kleinrock's office to tell him about it so he could come see for himself. Back in the UCLA lab, Klein logged on to the SRI machine and was able to execute commands on the 940's timesharing system. The SRI computer in Menlo Park responded as if the Sigma 7 in LA was a bona fide dumb terminal. There is no small irony in the fact that the first program used over the network was one that made the distant computer masquerade as a terminal. All that work to get two computers talking to each other, and they ended up in the very same master-slave situation the network was supposed to eliminate. Then again, technological advances often begin with attempts to do something familiar. Researchers build trust in new technology by demonstrating that we can use it to do things we understand. Once they've done that, the next steps begin to unfold, as people start to think even further ahead. As people assimilate change, the next generation of ideas is already evolving. A network now existed. IMP number 3 was installed at UC Santa Barbara on November 1st. For the Santa Barbara installation, Barker flew out to California again. By this time, Hart was more relaxed. There were few traces of the suspense that had attended the first trip. In fact, installing IMPs was beginning to seem routine. Later that month, Larry Roberts decided to fly to California to inspect the network firsthand for the first time. Roberts didn't like to travel. When he did travel, he never left to catch his plane until the last minute. It drove his secretary crazy, but he missed only one plane that anyone could remember. That happened one afternoon when he was stopped for speeding on his way to Dulles Airport. Convinced that he hadn't been going too fast, Roberts decided to contest the ticket. he had been pulled over by the squad car near the point at which he had come onto the George Washington Parkway after a full stop, and his contention was that in that short distance he could not possibly have accelerated his Volkswagen Beetle to the speed alleged by the officer. Roberts went back to the scene and carefully measured off the distances. He gathered data on the engine output and weight of his VW Bug, factored in Newton's law of inertia, and made a few other calculations, and was prepared to go before a judge to make his case. It wasn't until friends convinced him he was unlikely to get a judge with a physics degree that he conceded the point and paid the fine instead of taking it to court. Fortunately, there were no speeding tickets on this trip. Roberts and his program manager, Barry Wessler, flew to California without incident, and in Kleinrock's lab at Boulter Hall they watched the network in operation. This time Kleinrock did the typing, and in less than a minute he had logged on to the host computer at SRI. Roberts watched closely and left satisfied that the experiment was succeeding. Fourth was Utah. By now it was December, prime ski season. There also happened to be a network working group meeting scheduled at the site. Keen skiers all, the whole BBN team, even Frank Hart, went to Salt Lake City to plug in the imp. Ironically, Barker was the only one excluded from the Utah trip, a fact he would not let the others forget for many years. The layout of the growing number of communications links was becoming an interesting problem. For one thing, there was not a point-to-point link between every pair of sites. For reasons of economy, Roberts decided that no direct link was needed between UCLA and Utah, or between Santa Barbara and Utah, so that all traffic destined for Utah had to go through the imp at SRI. That was fine as long as it was up and running. If it crashed, the network would divide and Utah would be cut off until SRI was brought back online. As it would turn out, the four-node network that Roberts designed was not a robust web of redundant connections. Disruptions in the system also manifested themselves in less obvious ways. This was made clear very early, when the students at Santa Barbara began doing exactly what Hart had feared they might, fiddling with their new toy. And their attitude was, why not? They had never had to worry about outside connections, and it didn't occur to them that something they did in their computer lab might have an effect elsewhere. "We merely thought the imp was ours to play with," recalled Roland Bryan, a Santa Barbara researcher. "We were testing it out, turning it on and off, resetting it, reloading it, and trying again." As a result, people who were taking network measurements and who counted on the network path through Santa Barbara would have their experiment thrown off. "Although we did not hurt the links between other sites, we were disrupting the data traffic analysis being carried on by BBN and UCLA," Bryan said. "We didn't think about the fact that every time we did that, someone out there would suffer." By the end of 1969, the network working group still hadn't come up with a host-to-host protocol. Under duress to show something to ARPA at a meeting with Roberts in December, the group presented a patched-together protocol, Telnet, that allowed for remote logins. Roberts was not pleased with the limited scope of the effort. Though Telnet was clearly useful and fundamental in that it let one terminal reach multiple remote computers, a remote login program by itself didn't solve the problem of letting two computers work together. Moreover, Telnet was a way to use the network, not a lower-level building block. Roberts sent them back to keep trying. After another year of meetings and several dozen RFCs, in the summer of 1970 the group re-emerged with a preliminary version of a protocol for basic, unadorned host-to-host communications. When the Glitch Cleaning Committee finished its work a year later, the NWG at last produced a complete protocol. It was called the Network Control Protocol, or NCP. In January 1970, Bob Kahn decided that with the first four nodes working, it was time to test his various scenarios in which the network could suffer congestive failure. The kind of lockup that most worried him, the scenario he had suggested to Crowther months earlier, would be caused by congestion at a destination imp. He had speculated that storage buffers would become so full that the packets necessary for reassembling messages wouldn't be able to flow into a destination imp, which itself would be filled with dismembered message parts awaiting completion. To test that hypothesis and appease Kahn, Hart suggested that Kahn and Dave Walden fly out to Los Angeles and put the network through its paces. Kahn had several experiments in mind. He wanted to send all possible permutations of traffic from imp to imp, changing the size of the packets and the frequency at which they were sent, in an attempt to induce deadlock. Walden went along because he was the hands-on programmer who knew how to manipulate the code and make the packets do what Kahn wanted them to do. Walden took charge of reconfiguring the imps to send traffic in specific patterns. He could elongate or truncate the packets, send them out every 3 seconds or every half second. The imp software, the algorithms, the whole design was in for a major wringing out. The first thing Kahn set up was a test to demonstrate that his fear of a reassembly lockup was well-founded. Just as Kahn had predicted, by besieging the imps with packets, within a few minutes he and Walden were able to force the network into catatonia. "I think we did it in the first 12 packets," Kahn recalled. "The whole thing came to a grinding halt." Kahn was vindicated. He and Walden stayed on for a number of days, continuing the experiments. For Walden, who had spent so many months cooped up in Cambridge writing code in a quasi-vacuum, it was gratifying to see the network in operation, even if his goal now was to break it. He was having a blast. "I was hacking for pay," Walden recalled. "I was driven to learn as much as I could, as fast as I could." Kahn and Walden established a routine. Every morning they got up and ate breakfast at the Sambo's restaurant next to their hotel in Santa Monica. Walden used these mornings as an opportunity to indulge his native Californian's taste for fresh-squeezed orange juice, still a rarity back in Boston. Then they drove to the UCLA campus and spent all day and much of the evening testing the limits of the imps. Sometimes they took a dinner break. Sometimes they didn't notice that dinner time had come and gone. They took one night off to see the movie MASH, which had just been released. Often they were joined by Cerf, and occasionally by Crocker and Postel as well. At one point in the testing, Cerf programmed the Sigma 7 to generate traffic to the imp and use the host machine to gather data on the results. This was the first time he had worked closely with Kahn on a challenging project, cementing a professional link that would last for years to come. By the end of the week, Kahn's notebook was filled with data proving his case. When he and Walden returned to Cambridge, they shared their findings with Crowther and Hart. Crowther didn't say much, but Kahn suspected that the battery of tests caused him to start thinking about the problem. Somehow, Crowther must have registered in the back of his mind that if two of us were coming back and reporting this problem, maybe there was an issue, Kahn said. Back in the lab, Crowther built a simulation of what Kahn and Walden had done in the field and discovered for himself that the network could indeed lock up. He reported his findings to a slightly crestfallen Hart, who instructed Crowther to work with Kahn on fixing the problem. "Bob got to feel a lot better, and Frank got to feel a little worse," Walden said of the entire episode. "Of course, Frank never thought the thing was perfect, but he always got discouraged when things didn't go right." Hart had every reason to look past the few flaws that were beginning to show up in the nascent network. After all, problems with congestion control could be fixed. On a larger scale, the company had taken on a risky experiment, involving ideas and techniques never tested before. And it had worked. The hardware worked and the software worked. And the unique ways in which ARPA went about its business and its relationship with its contractor worked too. Above all, the esoteric concept on which the entire enterprise turned, packet switching, worked. The predictions of utter failure were dead wrong. Chapter 6. Hacking Away and Hollering. The network was real, but with only 4 nodes clustered on the West Coast, its topology was simple, the experiment small. East Coast computing powerhouses like MIT and Lincoln Laboratory, where so much was happening, weren't connected. The very spot where Bob Taylor had daydreamed about a network, the ARPA terminal room in the Pentagon, wasn't yet wired in. Nor was BBN itself. All were awaiting new machines, which Honeywell promised were in production as Christmas came in 1969. The past 12 months had been rough on ARPA. The agency's budget had reached a historic peak and gone into decline. The Vietnam War was consuming everything. In December 1969, ARPA had been pushed out of its headquarters in the Pentagon and forced to move into a leased office building in Arlington, Virginia. Director Stephen Lukasik called it the American equivalent of being banished to Siberia. The ARPA that once raided a Pentagon-issue American flag behind the director's desk was quietly stripped of such trappings. Despite low morale, ARPA officials kept their flag and displayed it in the new headquarters, hoping no one important would notice that it had only 48 stars. Computing continued to be the one line in the agency's budget that didn't turn downward at the beginning of the 1970s. Larry Roberts was determined to win support from the top, and did. He was equally determined to get an additional 12 principal investigators across the country to buy into the idea of the ARPA network. He kept pushing. He kept steady pressure on new sites to prepare for the day when an imp would arrive at their doors with a team from BBN to connect their host computers to the network. It wasn't a question of if, but when, and Roberts always posed it that way. In Cambridge, the activity on Moulton Street began taking on an air of production. The factory, some called it. The majority of the effort moved into the large room at the back of the low building with the loading dock, where deliveries from Honeywell were received, and there each new machine was set up to be debugged and tested before being shipped into the field. At the same time, Hart's team continued apace improving the design of the IMP, developing, testing, and tweaking the software and hardware. The 5th, 6th, and 7th 516 computers arrived from Honeywell in the first months of the year. In late March, the first cross-country circuit in the ARPA experimental network was installed. The new 50-kilobit line connecting UCLA's computer center to BBN's Moulton Street site, which became the 5th node in the network. And it wasn't just a breakthrough symbolically from the West Coast to the East, frontier expansion in reverse. The transcontinental link was also an immediate boon to network maintenance and troubleshooting. In the months before BBN had its own machine and was connected to the network, dealing with network problems in the 4-node cluster out west was a job handled by people who were on site. More often than not, it meant someone in California or Utah would spend hours on the phone talking cross-country with someone at BBN, while the unfortunate soul who had volunteered to fix the problem shuttled between the telephone and the IMP to carry out the verbal instructions coming from Cambridge. During the early going, Hart's team spent a lot of time on the phone and kept more or less continuous presence in the field, parentally guiding the startup of the infant network. At one point, Walden flew to Utah, Stanford, Santa Barbara, and UCLA to hand-deliver a new software release. But when an IMP was installed at BBN in the early spring of 1970, suddenly there was a way to ship data and status reports electronically from the West Coast IMPs directly back to BBN. Hart's obsession with reliability had resulted in more than computers encased in heavy steel. His insistence on building robust computers, and on maintaining control over the computers he put in the field, had inspired the BBN team to invent a technology: remote maintenance and diagnostics. The BBN team had designed into the IMPs and the network the ability to control these machines from afar. This they used both for troubleshooting and sometimes actually fixing the message processors by remote control, as well as keeping a watchful eye on the imps 24 hours a day. Horrified as he was at the prospect of graduate students messing with his imps, Hart had sought to build machines that could run largely unattended. He channeled his obsession into inventing this set of remarkably useful tools and system management techniques. Features for the remote control of the network had been built integrally throughout the IMP's hardware and software designs. At BBN, on the hardware side, a teletype terminal with logging capabilities was added to the BBN message processor, along with special warning lights and an audible alarm to indicate network failures. In designing the IMPs, BBN made it possible to loop the host and modem interfaces of the machine so they could conduct loopback tests. The loopback test, which could be performed remotely, connected an IMP's output to its input, effectively isolating the IMP from the rest of the network. This generated test traffic through the interface and allowed BBN to check the returning traffic against the outgoing traffic generated by the IMP. Loop tests were extremely important. They provided a way of isolating sources of trouble. By a process of elimination, looping one component or another, BBN could determine whether a problem lay with the phone lines, the modems, or an IMP itself. If test traffic completed the loop intact and error-free, then the problem was almost certainly in some exterior portion of a circuit, most likely in the phone company's lines or in the modems. And the loopback tests were conducted often enough that two of the IMP guys, Ben Barker and Marty Thrope, became expert at whistling down the line at just the right frequency to imitate the signals that the telephone company used to test the lines. From the PDP-1 computer room at Moulton Street, where BBN's network monitoring equipment was installed, the IMP guys could tell when a phone circuit anywhere in the network acted up. They could see, by the quality of messages and packets crossing a circuit, when the signal quality was being degraded, when the line was dropping bits, when it was introducing noise or fading altogether. When the problem was in the phone lines or the modems, then the phone company would be called upon to fix it.